All right. So I think it was Rosh Hashanah. It was one of the Jewish holidays. Me, my sister's family, and my brother's family are all having a holiday dinner at my sister's apartment on the Upper East Side. And all the kids are there. It's just like, I don't know, it's like 14 of us or something. And somebody says something about weight. My nephew, my 25-year-old nephew, who's like 6'4", says something about weight. And I'm like, and I laugh. I go, dude, you got nothing to say to me. You lost all this weight for your wedding. You put it all back and then some. Huh. To which my brother laughs at me mocking our nephew. And I'm like, dude, you're the last one of us to say anything about weight. You're the fattest I've ever seen you. If you were a stock, you would declare a 3-for-1 split. That's how much your numbers have gone up.
That's mean.
So my brother-in-law, who's the thinnest of all of us, marched us all into the bathroom. We all weigh ourselves.
Yes.
And my brother was the most, I think I've ever, he definitely was the most we've ever seen. Yikes. We make a $20 a pound bet for 6 months forward, which was supposed to be like April 10th.
But $20 a pound. All right. So if you lost 10 pounds, it's $200. 20 right. pounds.
Well, but if the other guy lost 9 pounds, you only win 20.
Okay. All right.
And it's three ways. So everybody puts into the pot.
Did someone give you this idea? This is a great idea.
No, just, you know, I'm creative that way. So someone else must have done that somewhere in history. So fast forward, March, the lockdown begins. We're not going to get together for the April weigh-in. We all agree to hold it in abeyance, the weigh-in, and we say we'll roll it over till September, as if we'll all be out and about in September. And then September, we rolled it over again till January. But here's the crazy part. Since I know I'm not in a bet and I'm not going to have the weigh-in for months and months, and because we're stuck at home all the time, I fancy myself a half decent. I'm pretty good in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So we start.
I've had your cooking. It was very good. I really enjoyed the meal you made me.
Right. So I know my way around a barbecue. I know my way around a kitchen. I have a bunch of cookbooks. And now we're stuck at home. And normally I'm commuting to the city and coming home. My wife does all the cooking. Mm. Since I'm no longer have the excuse that, hey, I'm by the time I get home, it's too late for me to cook. I take over all the cooking duties at home. And I am now cooking 3 meals a day, nothing but fresh food, nothing prepared, no restaurants, no frozen food.
That is impressive.
And eating a ton of food and losing weight. Mm. That's the funny part. So how is that possible? Well, we're eating salad with every dinner. The food is fresh. There's nothing prepared. There's nothing processed. Yeah. And more importantly, nobody is giving you a portion. Like, when restaurants serve food, they're not serving what they think is a human portion. They're serving what will get this person back to the restaurant again. Mm. So rather than serve a normal portion, it's a double or a portion and a half. Right. And we're all basically, you put a plate in front of us. We were all taught there are starving kids around the world. Finish your plate. So we all have a tendency to. So I lose like 10, 12 pounds in the first 3-4 months of lockdown.
That's awesome.
Absolutely not hungry, eating all the time.
Yeah.
But like eating fruit and whatever.
Eating
and
healthier, more efficiently, being happy and losing weight. That's hard to do. A big accomplishment.
So then last month, really in October, we were supposed to start the kitchen renovation in March. Mm-hmm. That got postponed when by August, all the materials start coming in again. And in October, we start on the kitchen. We've been in this house for over 6 years, and the kitchen was the original horrific 1983 four mic, just terrible. And in the month and a half that the kitchen renovation has been underway, I put all the weight back on.
Because
we're essentially doing nothing but takeout. It's all takeout.
But there's still time for you to
once the kitchen is done, I'm going right back to what I was doing.
That's
only with a nicer gas stovetop instead of
because you've been eating takeout. That's why.
Yeah, it's all takeout.
And is that but they're still generally probably pretty healthy, pretty fresh places. Is it just bigger portions in general?
It's a Chinese food, sushi.
Yeah.
The local pub, take out wings and salad. It's more wings than salad. You know, and it's also your boy. You can't eat the same crap over. You're constantly give me something. When you're cooking, hey, you could give me the same 20 ingredients and I can make 1,000 different things. Just a little bit more of some cumin here and some garlic there, and it's a totally different dish. Takeout is takeout, and there's only so much variety. Even if you're trying to be good, like sushi, throw in the gyoza, what the hell? So
I hear you, and it's very honest of you to share all that, and also a pretty creative idea. I love it. I wanted to ask you, you've got three really good pieces on the blog that I want to talk about. Everybody should go to redhalt.com. The big picture, everybody. But before we get to it, I do want to ask you about what you think about here the transition. We've heard some of Joe Biden's nominees for certain positions. I obviously want to get your take on all positions that affect economics and finance and so on. We have Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
That was a great pick. I saw the usual lunatics objecting to it.
Were they on the left, right? It's interesting to watch both. The left right now.
I mean, I think the left is okay.
I'm not interested in watching the right, anybody on the right at all. I can care less about what they think based on the fact that they, you know, confirmed nominations that they did for Trump.
In economics, left and right is different than in politics. I mean, this is some overlap, but when you talk about left and right in economics, you're often talking about hard money zealots, people who think the dollar should be backed by gold, just all sorts of mayhem that I don't think really is especially.
Well, you're talking about a difference in morality, really, as well as evidence-based arguments on economics in general, right? You're talking about, I mean, on the right, they're conspiratorial. They believe the tax cuts grow the economy. It's all bullshit, not to mention the Fed and deficits and so on. All those economic theories are like, we even paying attention to those anymore. That's the right. And even furthermore, on the right, morally, it's like, what do you think government's role should be? Whereas the rest of us, I think we have a pretty hearty debate.
So what I've seen on the right,
is that too dismissive?
You have to recognize which debates are nonsense, which arguments are nonsense, and strike them down immediately. And so, I had written about this 2 years ago. I called them the faux deficit chicken hawks.
Yeah, you've written about this extensively.
That when they're out of power, the deficit is the worst thing in the world. But while they're in power, deficits don't matter. Hey, elections have consequences. So you are already seeing the bullshit anti-deficit nonsense come out of the right. You've seen it from Art Laffer. You've seen it from The Hill, which is supposed to be a centrist site. But I find it kind of center right, and I find a lot of their arguments just complete bullshit.
Well, they post a lot of horseshit opinion pieces, I think. Yeah. But Art Laffer should not be considered a serious person. You would tell you have. I trust
Bruce
your opinion.
Bruce Bartlett would certainly agree with you.
Well,
you know, our mutual friend Bruce Bartlett.
That's why I think I have this opinion. So would I like Hartman? What's his name?
Or Austin Goolsbee, for that matter. But would not buy into it. So you could tell, and I think we were too sanguine about this. You know, the people who supported the Bush tax cuts and the Iraq invasion suddenly became deficit hawks under Obama. And I think, you know, there have been some positive takeaways from the Trump experience, which we'll talk about in a future conversation. But one of the takeaways has been, one of the positives have been belatedly and insufficiently, but eventually the media figured out how to deal with bullshit. And you'll notice it's what various people call a truth sandwich. And the truth sandwich is if you just say something is a lie and you try and debunk it, the boomerang effect has people believing it even more than they originally did. You can't just say, oh, the election was fraud. You need to put in a truth sandwich. And a truth sandwich is something like, you know, despite the head of the cybersecurity and election overseer saying this was the safest, most reliable election in American history, the president is claiming fraud. He has not produced any evidence for fraud.
Right.
In fact, all of his court cases have been thrown out, but one, and that one allowed observers to move from 10 feet to 6 feet.
And of
but
course, the Department of Justice
33 in litigation. And as far as anybody can tell, there's no, that's a truth sandwich,
right?
A statement, starting out with a truthful statement, the bullshit in the middle, wrapping it up with a truthful statement. Psychologically, that doesn't lead to people believing, because fact checking is almost counterproductive the way it's done. Eventually, the media figured it out.
I love your explanation on that truth sandwich. But getting back to the economic appointment. Sure. So Janet Yellen.
Good pick. Experienced, savvy, highly regarded by people on both sides of the aisle. I think the job of Federal Reserve Chairman is more powerful and has less political,
right,
which is her old job, in case. That you have to do.
Yeah.
Versus Treasury Secretary, where you're dealing with the House, you're dealing with the Senate, you're dealing with the various, you know, you're dealing with, you're running a giant department. Treasury is thousands and thousands of workers. There's so many different things under Treasury. It's crazy. I believe the IRS is under Treasury. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, I think, is under it's just a massive, massive department, all this stuff. So, but she's good. She ran the Fed, so she knows how to run a big organization. Now the challenge is going to be dealing with a Senate that's going to perhaps be less friendly, depending on what happens in Georgia.
It'll be really interesting just to watch the way that she behaves, given that her last job was chairman of the Fed, which, as you just mentioned, is not a political job, generally speaking.
Well, it is.
Well, it is, but even Trump's Fed chairmen seem to be very low key. They don't give interviews. They don't do a lot of commentary.
Jerome Powell has, you know, there's another thing we'll discuss off in the future in that conversation, which is the surprising resiliency of American institutions. As much as the noise day to day has been so annoying and just un-American and even treasonous at times, the institutions have withstood the challenge. And, you know, to some degree, some of that's because Trump is not the most competent executive, but it also says something about how well designed these institutions are.
I think I would generally agree if we're going to be general about it, but I do wonder what you think about, yes, they survived. Yes, they did in many ways what we hoped that they would do, especially the courts here in the end with this bullshit about the election.
But how damaged are they?
But yes. How damaged are the reputation of the institutions that you say survived? That
so
matters.
We'll find out
what the public.
I think it's too early to tell.
Yeah. So Biden's appointments to his economic team. Anybody else that you wanted to mention that's worth mentioning in the conversation with me today from Neera Tanden?
I don't understand what the beef is about the woman who they nominated to be head of OMB,
Director of Office of Management and Budget, Neera Tanden.
They said she had some tweets that were mean.
Well, she was very critical. She's been very critical of Bernie Sanders and his campaign. She's also was critical of the last election and insinuated that the Russians influenced it to the point that they might have even changed votes.
We know
votes.
The Russians tried to influence it. We don't know how successful they
I haven't read that much. I know her from running. She ran the Center for American Progress, which people can decide
left of center for sure
how they feel about that think tank. Yeah, definitely left of center, but not left enough for a lot of people. And I think that's the main knock on her, is that she is was very anti-Bernie.
Goddamn, too centrist.
Anybody else though? I'll be talking about her, I'm sure, with other guests.
You know, the whatchamacallit, I
the chair of the Economic Council of Economic Advisors is Celia Rouse. Jared Bernstein and Heather Boshe are members of the Council of Economic Advisors.
Jared.
I don't know what the hell any of these people really even do in those jobs, but
they help shape policy and they advise the president. And, and those are important jobs. You know, it's kind of interesting. The communications office, after the parade of people we've seen blow through that, one liar after another, except my friend Mooch, who was fired for telling the truth to a reporter about what a clusterfuck it was. That's pretty much why he got shit canned. It will be nice to see media professionals there, not coming out to gaslight America and basically blow smoke up everybody's ass. I mean, this is, nobody wants to use the Nazi comparison, but this has been just 4 years of bullshit. It's shocking starting with Inauguration Day, the greatest crowd ever.
Yeah.
By the way, 306, the greatest landslide ever. It just, you know, it's amazing how lacking in character the outgoing president was, and how what's amazing is how many people just bent to his will. There's just so little spine in D.C. It's a jelly spine
on everything
city.
From the impeachment to the actual election.
Cowards
bending to his
and
will
traitors and
seeing
and assholes. Yeah. Oh my! It's just think about how. You know who I give a lot of credit to? The guy who was Trump's appointment to be head of cybersecurity. He asked
Chris Krebs.
Just on
yeah, I played
minutes.
Him on yesterday's podcast. He seems
fantastic.
Like a guy got a lot of integrity, real smart lawyer.
Yeah, he stood up and said, "Hey, this was a legit election. I'm sorry. I'm not going to lie to assuage your tiny little ego."
Yeah, and he was and, that 60 Minutes piece was great. He was like, "We were in basically a Situation Room like space. We had people from FBI, from Homeland Security, from." You know, everywhere watching this election to make sure there wasn't any intervention, right. any hacking, et cetera. Right. And, you know, it came out clean. And then Bill Barr, of course, today, Bill Barr saying, I didn't see any major
no
fraud,
evidence.
No evidence of fraud anywhere. And so,
well, by the way, you notice what Barr said. Barr's still a weasel.
Yeah.
He said there was not sufficient evidence of fraud to overturn the election results. Like he still had to blow a little kiss to the toddler in chief.
Fair
what
point.
He should have said is, there's no evidence of fraud because as far as we can tell, there was no fraud. Accept your loss and move on. You know, when you look around the country, even Governor Ducey, who I thought was a kiss ass
of Arizona,
suck up in Arizona, basically said to Trump, hey, the people of Arizona voted.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to certify this. What's astonishing is the lack of pushback to the president of the United States saying, fuck democracy. Don't approve what your own voters do. Like nobody is responding to how absolutely insane that is. I don't see enough of people saying, hey, comrade, in America, the voters pick the president.
Well, the
other way around.
The converse of that, and you just opposed the statements from Bill Barr. We don't see any enough fraud to overthrow any state's election, affect the outcome of any state's election. Okay, fine. But the better statement
still
did come
easily.
From. Did come from Chris Krebs, who said this was the most secure election in American history, 2020.
Right.
And here's the thing. Government doesn't do a great job at this, and they're really not designed to tout their achievements. Every secretary of state, if they do a good job, if they're good at their job, they have an election takes place and it's free and fair. And it's there's access and it's counted accurately. If you succeed, tout the hell out of that. And basically, that's what a lot of them are doing. Like, listen, it wasn't the outcome I wanted, but it was clean. Sorry. Clean fight.
Right. So you had the governor of Georgia stepping and the secretary of state of Georgia, both Republicans stepping up. You had
Trump called the secretary of state the enemy of the state, Barry. You know what damaging
so
that is? Guy
shocking,
who donated
shocking.
To his campaign.
Right, right. He actually wrote an op-ed in the USA Today
that's
saying,
right, yeah.
Me and my family voted for Trump. We donated to him and he still threw us under the bus. The most shocking takeaway of all this. Oh, and who is this idiot who called for Krebs to be shot at dawn?
That's a guy named Joe DeNova. He's on
DeNova.
Trump's campaign lawyer team. He was on Newsmax.
So I think if I was advising Krebs, I would say file as many lawsuits as you can against him, and then file a claim on. With the Bar Association, wherever he's authorized, admitted to the bar, because this person and the same with Sydney Lunatic working with Giuliani. These people are not qualified to be officers of the court. It's you want to go out as a public person and say crazy shit. Go ahead. We'll just mute you on Twitter. But if you're an officer of the court in the middle of litigation making claims, you can't go out and talk about stuff that is false and you know is false.
I don't want to go off on too far a tangent, but that's also the difference between being a talk show host on the radio or on YouTube, like Mark Levin or Sean Hannity, and being a lawyer and a judge in a court. You can say whatever the hell you want, make a case. And they do to Republican legislators. Why don't you do something? Mark Levin says. And they're like, I can't. What do you mean? There's nothing I can
do.
I'll
tell you why. This comes back to the issue of the institutions being resilient.
Mm-hmm.
When you, and that was a whole joke of the non-zero number of counters in the room. when you are in court, you know, there's a lot of leeway to your judgment and opinion matter. And when a judge asks you a question, judges in America are the last landed gentry. Like a judge, I don't care if you're the attorney general, the judge could throw you in jail and contempt, and you would then have to go get a writ of habeas corpus to be removed, but you're spending the night in jail until that shows up. So when the judge says to the lawyer, you alleged fraud, but I don't see anything in the papers. Is there any fraud? Are you making a claim for fraud? It's like, well, no.
Right.
Well, you said there were the client said there was zero observers in the room. How many of the president's campaign observers were in the room? There was a non-zero number of people, which is a way of saying, well, of course there were people in the room. But if you say there weren't and evidence comes in, it's not just that you lose the case. You're going to be sanctioned. You're going to pay fines. And I've seen judges call people into, you know, chambers and basically say, you have exactly 1 hour to make this right, or I'm going to turn this over to the Bar Association and recommend your suspension. Oh, wow.
Really? Well,
judges don't fuck around. I mean, if you've ever been in court, it is no bullshit. There is no fooling around, which is why all of these bullshit claims.
And they're in that robe and they're higher than you and they have a hammer. The whole situation is intimidating.
Please rise when the judge enters. This is
the whole dynamic is rigged.
This is not just, you know, this is not just trappings. This person has control over your future.
Law and order. Law and order. So it's
so crazy stuff.
Well, and the argument, of course, that Trump is making is Joe Biden has to prove that he got the votes.
It doesn't work that way.
That Trump has to prove that
make that argument in court. You could what you say on Twitter, what the crazies say at night on Fox is not admissible evidence. And well, I think they were 1 for 32 or 1 for 33, whatever it was. It was pretty wild. So anyway, that's the next couple of pieces that I'm working on. I think it's fascinating topic.
Well, speaking of fascinating topics, I've got three blogs entries of yours at the big picture, ritholtz.com, that I want to talk about. They are all fascinating topics, and I want to try to get through them. The first piece here I want to talk about is dealing with COVID and where we are at right now.
Yes.
And you have a great way of looking at this and of providing perspective in this piece titled The Halfway Point. It's very good. I really enjoyed reading it. It helped me understand and have perspective. What was your approach? What gave you this idea for this piece? The Halfway Point.
So basically, the lockdown began in March. And in November, we had a slew of different virus vaccine updates from Pfizer, from Moderna, from AstraZeneca. Those are the three leading candidates that are expected to be out pretty quickly. In fact, Pfizer is 20 million doses this month, 25 next month, 30 in February. And so I just did a little research and figured out from all the public statements about when we will have had sufficient vaccines outside so that you can feel comfortable resuming your normal life. And back of the envelope, rough calculation was somewhere around June, right? By the way, this isn't anything any of the company said. This isn't hard science. This was just, 6-7 months is about
you're using the best information you can to create a time frame. And I think it's as good as anybody would say. Right. And I think experts would look at it and be like, that's reasonable.
I'm not betting the house on that, but I think that's a fair number.
Sure.
And, I kind of I like numbers. And so I sat and I just sort of thought, well, if we started in March and we end in June, that's, inclusive of all the months, that's 16 months, 8 months past March is November. Oh my God, we're literally at the halfway point. And so I looked back from March till now, and in the first half of the lockdown, you have no idea how long this is going to last. You have no idea how dangerous and serious this is. So it's dangerous, but it's less dangerous in some ways than we thought and more dangerous in other ways. And You know, your whole lifestyle changes to adapt, to be safe, to keep you and your family safe. So the thought is, and you know, I did a lot of stuff I wanted to do, but there's a lot of stuff I didn't get to. And I stopped and I thought, well, if we're at the halfway point,
yeah,
you know, this is the time to go into the locker room and get the team all roused up. What do I want to look back at from June? Project yourself forward in time. Hey, the lockdowns are over. The vaccine is widely distributed. People are out and about. What do I want to look back to 8 months of forced living at home and say I got accomplished?
I love what you wrote here. I'm just going to read it. You wrote, imagine someone came to you and said the following. You'll be locked up at home with only limited ability to travel locally for 6 months to a year. You can do whatever you want over that period. What would you want the result of that soft incarceration to be? And you've been thinking about this, and you provide a lot of perspective, given into consideration that not everybody is obviously able to work from home and so on. I think that's fair,
right,
that we understand. But you say you bring this up because the midpoint creates a chance to think about our own habits, goals, experiences, and a word that begins with D I've never seen in my life. It looks Latin. What is that? Deodamnatus? Deodamnatus, you wrote?
Oh.
The hell
it's
is that?
It's Latin for damn it.
Oh, never knew that.
In our lives,
and what we want to accomplish with them. And the recognition of this, you say, Barry, should spur you to think about how fruitfully or not, I like that, you choose to spend your time.
Yeah, if you decide that, hey, I work my ass off all the time and 6 months more of not having to tote that barge and lift that bale or whatever it is, that, you know, that's a choice some people might make either voluntarily or involuntarily. I have a very different attitude, which is life is short. What do you want to accomplish?
Mm.
And I have stuff I want to do. And so I put together a list that covered a bunch of things. We talked about cooking earlier. I mentioned, and we're in mid kitchen renovation. I got a couple of new cookbooks, including one that I'm really fascinated by, which is salt, acid, fat, sweet. I forgot the name, but it's really a fascinating way to think about how flavors interact, how food interacts.
But basically, and you wrote this list of how I'm hoping to spend my extra free lockdown time. And you say, of course, note all this aside from your professional life. So you're suggesting people at the, I love this. It's so helpful for me.
Think about how much time people lose commuting. I mean, my commute isn't bad, but it's still 10 hours a week. I know people commute 20 hours a week. That commute time is now captured.
Yep.
What are you going to do with, you know, the next 250 to 500 free hours you get? That's a big chunk of time that you normally don't have.
I love it. You say, think about how unique this situation is, how rare an opportunity it presents for you, and then go take full advantage of it. What do you want this period to have meant to you? Do not lead a life full of regrets and unrequited interest. What do you want to do with the next 8 months of your life is such a great question. I love this blog. I hope people share it widely and read it. And I'll say this just real quick. You have your list. One thing that Val and I are really trying to make happen is we're trying to take off. Our daughters are in 7th and 10th grade. They're never going to have an opportunity, most likely, hopefully, to have to do remote learning. Why stay here in the dead of winter, especially since my wife hates winter? I don't mind it as much. So we're thinking of like going down to the Atlanta area where we have a whole community of friends at Sarah and B and staying there for at least a month.
Right.
What do you think of that? Too risky?
I had a friend who a month ago just was up in Martha's Vineyard.
You can
it's
go anywhere.
Season. Right. It's
if
just
you
like
could
just
go
a change.
Anywhere. Yeah. This will never be this opportunity again while our kids are at this age, you know? And I mean, I can work from anywhere. My wife can kind of work from anywhere. So why the hell not? That's our dream, our fantasy we're trying to make happen.
So one of the things that motivated me to do that is, you know, the whole Groundhog Day sensation of, you know, the sameness of it every day in the same place. What are you doing? What's different? Every day I write up and print up a list of my things to do. And every day I do another one. And what I don't cross off the list, I roll over to the next day.
Wow.
And there's just a sameness to everything. And so, you know, we're bored. We're frustrated. it's now it's getting dark earlier. It's getting colder. All the leaves are off the trees. You know, it's like, I don't want to succumb. I don't want to allow myself to get sucked into that negative, dreary winter under best of circumstances.
Right.
And now with the lockdown, the potential of this being terrible was there. And so I was trying to be proactive to head off that
Well, you were, and it's super helpful, and you're helping yourself and helping so many others while you're at it. Barry Ritholtz.
Thank you.
Okay, blog piece number two I want to discuss with you. You just posted at Ritholtz.com, the big picture, the bargain hunter's dilemma. Another fascinating piece about behavior and psychology, and I don't know how to describe this, but the one line I like that helps describe it in here is there are ways to manage the lure of consumerism. Where did this idea for a piece come from? What were you struggling with here?
So I grew up kind of lower middle class, kind of poor, put myself through college, cheap state school, took out a bunch of loans to put myself through grad school. And then did a career change when I was 30. So, you know, the first half of my adult life and most of my childhood, you know, pretty hard scrabble, not a lot of cash. And the past, you know, 10, 15 years, that changed, right? Really go back to the mid 2000s. I'm one of the people that the financial crisis was good to me. I was in the right place at the right time. I called it right. It brought a lot of business to me. It wasn't like a calculated, let me just sit back and wait for a global clusterfuck and I'll nail that and they'll bring a lot of money to me. It just kind of happened. And yeah. So, you know, there's a concept in personal finance known as the hedonic treadmill. The hedonism, a hedonic adjustment is, what's the value of a passenger car? Well, there are ways to calculate it by retail price and this and that. But can you compare a passenger car in 2020 to 2000 to 1980? And so they make these hedonic adjustments. For example, an entry level Honda Civic today has things that a Civic 30 years ago didn't have. It has ABS. It has airbags. It has, you know, seatbelt tensioners. It has crumple
zones.
And
it's hot looking. It's sporty. I like those Civics. Go ahead.
Right. But I mean, I'm talking about an inexpensive entry level Honda that has all of the safety features that the best Volvos and Mercedes had 25 years ago. So how do you adjust that? So the hedonic treadmill is the tendency that whatever thrill you get from spending money on stuff, you know, it's like you got to look for a vein. You need a bigger hit each and every time. And so people who start early in their career making some money and go out and piss a lot of money away on baubles, and, you know, we all have a tendency to do that, they get on the hedonic treadmill and you can't get off because they just never get ahead. It's always bigger, more.
It's never enough. Never enough.
Right. And despite making more and more money, they never seem to save. They're always in debt. So anyway, I kind of see it from two perspectives by accident of birth. I'm like really the valley between the baby boomers who are all older than me, born in the late 40s and 50s, to the Gen Xers who were born like mid 60s and later. I sort of fall in between. And the boomers, probably the most materialistic generation in history. They were lucky. They got to capture all of the real estate appreciation, that big surge that took place in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Very prestige focused, very keep up with the Jones. And I kind of throughout my life always sort of felt the lure of that, but never fully fell into it. I have a nice house. I have a nice car, blah, blah, blah. But everything I own, I can afford with plenty of space. I could have afforded a bigger car. I could have afforded a more expensive house. I've because of my wife, I've always lived within my means. We've always been very moderate in our spending. Although, you know, the past couple of years, I picked up some toys here and there. And so it was Black Friday and I was just thinking about that. And I remembered this thing I did a long time ago when I really first started getting money. One of the things I pointed out, I went to grad school in New York, in Manhattan, and I lived in Manhattan a good couple of years after that, another, I don't know, 15 years after that, 10 years after that. And, you know, Manhattan is kind of an interesting city to be poor in, because there's a ton of stuff you can do for free.
Right.
You can get into museum nights on Fridays. There's no charge. And there are all these live events that are free. And, you know, so you rent poor, but it doesn't matter. Even food. When I was a grad student, I mean, I still remember Mamoon's over on University. You get a falafel sandwich and a soda.
I think you can find your places. That's $2. True.
Right. Yeah. Cheap and cheerful.
Groceries are always expensive, but you can find affordable.
It was cheaper to go to a local, you know, pick a, we would go down to St. Mark's and 6th Street, the Indian restaurants. There's literally a whole street of Indian restaurants. Mm. You couldn't spend $20. It was impossible. It was too much food. Like that would feed four people. And so I, you know, the problem, so you learn to be a savvy bargain hunter. You learn how to make your money go as far as it can. The problem, and this is me looking at the world through a lens of psychology. The problem is we all tend to want what we can't have. Hmm. And that's just a very human behavior. And when you're broke, you can't have a lot of things. And so it creates this, you know, Madison Avenue knows how to push those buttons. It creates a desire for things you may not even want. You may not even desire. And so I remember reading this fascinating thing about clothes. Take all the clothes in your closet and that are on hangers. And instead of normally you hang them away from you, you know, the hook goes like this, flip them around and hang them towards you.
Okay.
And wait a year. Whenever you wear a piece of clothing, take it off the hanger. When you're done, throw it in the hamper. But as soon as you take it off the hanger, put the hanger the normal way, facing away from you. And a year goes by and you realize, at least I realized, 80% of my clothes I don't wear. I wear the same shirts over and over again. Right. I wear the same pants over and over again. I have like a wall full of ties. I wear the same two or three ties over and over again. And so... so it made me stop to think about how we shop and how we almost treat materialism like a sport, you know, sports shopping. And I this is about 15 years ago. I came to the conclusion, I'm not going to buy anything unless I really want it. And I'm not going to look what's on sale and get a bunch of stuff and buy it. I'm going to look at a bunch of stuff, and if I really like it, I'm going to buy it regardless of price. And P.S., if I buy anything new, I have to give away two old things. I just empty out the closet of the crap I don't wear.
Sure.
And so I found myself not caring. Now, you have to have at least a little financial needs to do this, but it's probably cheaper in the long run to not buy bargain crap that's going to fall apart, to not buy the cheapest, least expensive thing, because there is something to be said for quality. But more importantly, you're only buying the things you really, really like. And if it's on sale, it shouldn't affect whether or not you desire it. We have a tendency to do the opposite. It's on sale and I can afford it, therefore I want it, which is the wrong way to go about it.
Yeah, or I think the only thing you don't answer is if a way to kill time or a hobby or interest is to actually go shopping on an Amazon or even on a Facebook Marketplace, and then you find things that you weren't even thinking about that you wanted or needed, but if they're marketed at you, obviously. But I mean,
listen, if you want to do that, if you want to go, if you just like, I have this, it's called Zillow surfing. People who are stuck at home go on Zillow and look at houses along the water or up by the ski area or by the lake.
I've done that many times.
Nothing wrong with that.
Right.
The problem comes when people start buying things they don't want, don't need, can't afford. Not only is it wasteful for, you know, the entire society, but it's not a good use of your money.
I do think there is something a little bit wrong with Zillow surfing. I find every time, which is the idea of having a sense of a feeling of envy and not realizing how good you've got at where you are at and how you, you know, you only be happy when you have this kind of house and this kind of place. Although I don't want to go to,
you know, the law of diminishing returns kicks in very, very quickly.
Right.
My favorite example of this, and this will date me, is so I grew up really liking stereos and great sound systems. Nobody gives a crap. Good enough beat, really good. The sound quality of the audio in your phone, hey, it's 100,000 songs. It doesn't have to be that great. It's endless, plus streaming. But I always used to be fascinated that, you know, $100 speakers sound pretty good. $500 speakers sound much better. $2,000 speakers, even better. But, you know, how much better are $10,000 speakers than $2,000?
Right.
Well, they're a little better. But are they five times better? What about the $100,000 speakers? You understand speakers, you could drop $250,000 on audio speakers. And it's just, you know, the same thing happens in the high end of automobiles. Get the next tenth of a second faster costs you $250,000.
This is what I'll say about houses and cars, though, and this is what I'm experiencing, is you want, generally speaking, unless you have a really passionate hobby and great skill at home improvement and fixing things, you want cars and homes that you won't have to spend a lot of time dealing with things breaking. Even if you have resources and you can hire someone to fix them, that's a pain in the ass to bring somebody over to it. You trust the car, the house. I try to fix most things myself, which is fine, but they're not done perfectly. They sometimes break again. And it's just, it takes a lot of time. I just want a house where I don't have things break down, a car where I don't have things break down, so I don't have to spend time and money, you know, stressing about it. And if that makes me spoiled rotten, fine. But that's what I think about with a house. But just a house that doesn't leak, please. That'd be great.
Yeah, I got a house that leaked, so you put in a new roof. It stops leaking.
Oh, I've done everything. So let me...
By the way, the fascinating thing about cars, you know, I'm a car guy.
Sure.
The quality of cars that are being made today, with a few exceptions, but generally speaking, you go out and buy a used car that's 3, 4, 5 years old, they're practically as good as new. So I have a bunch of cars. Every year I lease something through the business that's my daily driver, but everything else I have had over the past couple of years were all bought a couple of years old, and you don't need to pay full price. As soon as it gets driven off the lot, it depreciates 20-30%.
What is old? A couple of years and how many miles on a car for you?
All right. So my weekend car, I picked up off lease. Somebody in Indianapolis had a lease and it expired, and I got a 3-year-old car with 30,000 miles that I paid half of what it was new. And knew it was six figures plus. I don't want to spend that much money on a car. My wife's daily driver, we picked up a year old with 7,000 miles. And I paid, that's a 2 Series BMW. I think I paid $20,000 less than it would have been brand new because it had 7,000 miles. And it was the color combination she wanted. Well, she wanted the convertible and stick shift.
No, I think that's really good, especially to hear from you, for people to hear from you. Everybody wants to buy a new car because of the symbolism of it all. It's not rational necessarily for most people. And I would just suggest that someone like you doesn't use the phrase my daily driver, because obviously I was thinking about a person. But let me, you know, this.
No, my daily driver is the car you drive,
daily. I know. Right. I thought you were talking about Raul, but let's not talk about him. You say, though, the results of this experiment in this blog entry, you say you buy less stuff. You only buy good quality, better quality. You limit what you own. You save mental bandwidth. And I think most importantly for a lot of people, and the thing that I use as my most important value of currency is time. You save time.
So, you know, yesterday was Cyber Monday. I don't give a shit.
You don't want to find the deals, the things that you were thinking about getting, but yesterday would have been the day to get it.
No, I don't give a fuck. And the same with, you know, Black Friday. And I stopped all that crap a long time ago. And so I'll share my one.
There's
shopping
video
secret.
Of you rushing into a Walmart and trampling a child.
Oh
sir.
My God! I tweeted that, right? I said the best thing about COVID is this bullshit doesn't happen this year.
It's the weirdest. Just I feel so bad for those people.
Now, to be fair, there are people who are really broke. Really
yeah, that's
poor,
what I mean. I feel sympathy.
The only way their kids are going to get whatever widget they want is getting it as the loss leader at Walmart. You know, that's a bigger societal issue of having an underclass that is so poor, so far below the poverty level. That obviously that's not who that don't give a shit about prices is aimed at.
Fair enough.
I'm talking to to people who are, you know, making a little money or, you know, middle class. And, you know, do you really want to spend your time and energy hunting for baubles? So true story.
But you're also giving people advice. Sorry to interrupt, but you're giving people advice that to have more time, you can often find ways to make more money. Or how do you measure happiness? You can have more time to spend with the people you love doing the things you like. Sorry.
That's right.
You're about to tell a story about.
That's a fair point. So this is a house we're probably going to spend the next, you know, 20, 30 years of our lives in. The house we were in before this was sort of an accident. We were in contract for our sale. The buy fell through. We scrambled. We ended up in the wrong place, the wrong town, wrong part. It wasn't where we wanted to be. It was by the water, it was by a park, but it wasn't the town we wanted to be in. And so we were there for about 5-6 years. And then we moved here when at the end of about 4 or 5 years after the financial crisis. What I discovered in the process of moving here was that the basement in the old house was filled with hundreds of boxes of crap. This is the same concept as flipping the hangers over in the closet that we just hadn't opened for the 6 years we were in that house.
Yeah.
So before we moved here, my wife originally talked about, we'll move to the new house and deal with it. And I don't remember if it was her or me. It might've been her said, no, let's go through this. What you want to keep, you keep. What we can donate, we'll donate. And everything else we'll throw away. And so we went through 100 boxes. We cut down to 20 what we wanted to keep. We gave away about 50 boxes of just all sorts of things, clothes and furniture and equipment. And, you know, you buy crap and you never use it, or you use it once and it goes into the basement. And so we went from 2,000 square feet to 3,800 square feet with about 40, 50% less stuff. So the house that's twice as big has less junk in it than the house that was, 1,800, 2,000 square feet.
I think that's always fascinating when people figure that out and how to consolidate.
It took me way too long to figure. I should have figured that out 20 years ago. Yeah. If it wasn't for the fact that we figured out, we can move out of the house that we bought sort of, you know, we debated renting. We have too much crap to put into store. Back to all the accumulation of shit.
Someone should write. I bet you a billion people have written this, but I want you to write the blog post, and maybe you already have, about how having a lot of shit and actual physical clutter affects the way that you live.
I think it weighs you down. People have written about that.
People have. But for me, it's absolutely everything. I'm so affected by my space and I'm not great at it. Like when I'm saying I know my problem, clutter is a problem for me. Clutter, physical clutter creates psychological clutter is what I was trying to say.
I mean, I look out the window so I don't see the mess behind me, but,
I have to. You know, I have to keep on cleaning. There. Keep up, making sure I'm as organized as I can.
Look at all the books I have piled up on the floor.
Don't let me just. I don't even want to show my camera around my little
space. All right, I want
my little space, but there's stuff.
So
everywhere.
We're in about the same size space.
So anyway, the final piece I want to get to with you here is at your blog redholtz.com. The big picture, everybody, depoliticizing your feed. You write. Should you read it? The first paragraph is really good.
Sure, let me go to it.
You want me to read it?
No, I build my reputation on being a blunt, honest, and a bit off the center of mainstream. At the same time, no one wants to purposefully alienate half of their clients or listeners or readers. On occasion, it can be a challenge to thread that needle. So when Matt Phillips of the New York Times asked for some thoughts on markets in the age of Trump, I recognized how easily I could give offense. especially with the election barely over and nerves still raw. So rather than offering yet another hot take on policy or creating some unfounded market narrative, I went in a different direction. How to reduce the noise levels we all experience in the market. And so he went on to quote me about saying, "Oh, I read the wrong paragraph. You wanted me to read the New York Times paragraph."
No, you read exactly what you're supposed to. Oh,
okay. The money paragraph is, "I just want my life to go back to normal," said Barry Ritholtz, a money manager in New York who did not vote for Mr. Trump. I know that might surprise a few of you. "And I don't mean pre-pandemic normal. I mean pre-golden escalator to hell normal," he said, a reference to Mr. Trump's famous 2015 ride down the escalator in Trump Tower, at the end of which he announced his candidacy. "I just want the noise level to quiet down,"
yeah,
unquote. So that was a fun piece to be involved in because it was different than the usual sort of, you know, blah, blah, blah. Everybody makes up a narrative after the fact.
But what does it mean to depoliticize your feed?
So I feel obligated as somebody who manages assets for clients, mm-hmm, to not slide into the sort of bubble that we all tend to find ourselves in. Hey, this is a little bubble right here. This is a little progressive left of center bubble. Mm-hmm. I live on the East Coast. I live in New York, although Nassau County, the county I live in, voted Trump this election. Last election, they voted Hillary, which is kind of fascinating. So you really have to make an effort to not slip into a bubble. And you know, we all try with, you know, various degrees of success. So I felt obligated, since I kind of troll Twitter as much as I do, to follow the president, his senior advisors, his press secretary, his this, his that. And, you know, it's just a fire hose of endless bullshit. You know, on the economic side, it's less bad. The various Federal Reserve and Treasury Department official statements, the BLS stuff. There's a lot of stuff that I've been following for years and is pretty legitimate. But I just didn't feel I would be doing my job if I wasn't keeping up with what the White House was saying,
sure,
on a weekly or daily basis. And the best part, there are many great parts about the outcome of this election, but to me, one of my favorite parts was that I no longer have to follow this,
yep,
cadre of,
yep,
grifters and liars and fraudsters and criminals. And so I just start unfollowing them all. And, you know, McEnany, not only did I unfollow her, she's such a lying witch, I blocked her. It was so delightful to just say, fuck you. I never have to hear anything out of your lying pie hole again. And, you know, as you're working your way down the administration,
she actually joins us now in the conversation. Kaylee, what do you want to say to Barry Ritholtz after he called you a witch? Right.
I say this to you. So her first sentence was, "I will not lie to you, the press and the American people." And her second sentence was a lie.
Yeah.
And basically it was downhill from there.
Yeah, I went out for drinks with her once. Just me and her and her boyfriend at the time, I think, and right, my producer Alfred.
Yeah,
she's nice.
There was a fascinating article, I want to say Politico, a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
When it looked like it was going to be, a pretty substantial loss. And I don't think the outcome changed this. Where are all these people going to get jobs after this? They're tainted.
I actually don't think so. I used to think
Fox News and right wing think tanks that you could stick this. There are hundreds of wankers from this administration.
I used to think exactly that. And the one thought that I have that makes me think differently is that Donald Trump is a rock and roll star in many parts of this country. And if you had any tangential relationship with him or were working with him, you could probably go work at any firm in Oklahoma or Mississippi or Arkansas, you don't think you could just go work almost anywhere in any industry if you were tangentially related or worked in this way. I used to think it's like you go for a job interview after this and the person interviewing you says, it says you worked in the Trump White House. Wasn't that when it was on fire? I mean, the house was on fire. You worked there next. But now I think it's like, ooh, you worked in, we love Trump here. Come on, come work for our real estate firm, our bank, our communications company.
I don't think so. Why not?
Why?
By the way, if I have a Trump flag outside my house,
I run a business, I run a firm, and I live in a red state, and Kayleigh McEnany is going to come work for me? Oh, my God,
that's
great.
So what, she's going to take a $50,000 a year job as the PR head for a local landscaping company? What are you talking about? I mean, normally, under normal circumstances.
The kind of money they want, the kind of firms that they'd have to work at.
Normally, they end up as the, you know, as the spokesman for ExxonMobil. Right.
Former Bushies, former Obamas.
Google as the head of PR.
Yeah.
Not, you know,
George Stephanopoulos hosts The Week on ABC. He worked for Clinton.
I mean, the woman who I forget her name.
The Obama boys have the most popular podcast company in the company. Yeah.
So you look at what they do. They go out and they get, like, I don't think nobody from this White House is going to end up at a Fortune 500 company.
That is
at a C-level
a prediction, sir.
Right. I just don't see anybody. Mm. I'll tell you why. So I'll give you a perfect example.
Don't you think a lot of them get jobs in right-wing media?
There's only so many jobs in right-wing media.
I believe there are only so many jobs in media. That's why you do what I did. Any of them can do exactly what I've done. You just go create your own thing.
Let's say maybe. I mean,
make money. Pay me directly.
You know, it's. If Mike Bloomberg
won. Don Bongino is the most popular, like, that guy's making.
Blocked. He was part of that.
It doesn't matter. Blocked. Yeah, good for you. But I'm saying your point.
I don't have to listen to that crap anymore.
Your point about where are they going to work? And I'm saying for themselves, they're just going to talk into a microphone and launch a YouTube channel and make money.
Hypothetically, Mike Bloomberg wins the presidency. And I would have said, Mike, I want to be part of your communications team.
Uh-huh.
And so someone like Stephanie Ruhle or Tim O'Brien would have been the guy at the podium. And I would have been, you know, the number two or three guy writing out like that. That was, I could see that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you come out of that job and you basically run communications for Apple,
McDonald's,
Zillow or pick Facebook. Something. There are 1,000 fantastic companies with great stock option packages.
You're saying,
and you're set for life, right, and you get to do something.
No, you're right. You're right. No, you're absolutely right.
Those jobs.
That's better than making your own
scratch for
podcast.
As long as whatever is left over between Fox.
That'll be interesting. I'm going to hold you to that prediction, and we're going to follow. I'll follow closely because you have, sir, depoliticized your feed. This has been Depoliticizing Your Feed with Barry Ritholtz. Check out all of these blog entries, everybody, and I'll say all these things after I hit stop. But thank you very much, sir. That was so good. I love talking to you. I could talk to you for 10
Yeah, that was
hours.
Fun. And I don't know who's going to listen to this for an hour, but
a lot of people.
Me the audio, and I'll put it up on the blog.
Awesome. Thank you, sir.
All righty.
All right.